Good afternoon, all. I'd like to call the Senate Community and Regional Affairs Committee to order. Today is Thursday, March 15th. Let the record reflect. The time is 3:32. Today we have present Vice Chair Senator Myers, Senator Hoffman, Senator Gray Jackson, and myself, Senator Chair Hughes. We understand Senator Wilson is on his way. Thank you for Christopher Dickrall with Senate Records, Alex Benizak with LIO, and Dawson Mann, our aide. We have one big item on the agenda today. We'll be hearing a number of presentations as part of our overview entitled Assessing the Present and Looking to the Future, What Are the Broadband Gaps in Alaska? Each presenter will have 10 to 15 minutes to speak, followed by questions from members. And I will say each group entity has that much time. So if there are more than one or two people, they have to split that time. Before we begin, I'd like to inform the committee that on Thursday of next week, I plan for this committee to hear Senate Joint Resolution 13, Improved Broadband Internet Access. It's my intention to hear and move out SJR 13 at the same meeting, so we will only have one hearing. As a result, I will need amendments for SJR 13 to my office by Wednesday 21st at 3 p.m. So I encourage you to review those and be in touch with our office if you have any questions. Is there anything any members would like to say before we begin? With that, we will get going with our presentation. We're really excited. This is an important subject for our state because it impacts economic development, impacts the ability for people to work remotely, it impacts commerce, it impacts education, it impacts healthcare. And we have some wonderful access in parts of the state, and we're really lacking in other parts. So we want to, as a legislature, understand that and also work with our congressional members to help them know what might be helpful as far as infrastructure. So with that, we're going to start at the state level, and we're going to start kind of down on the ground and work our way up into the air as we go throughout this presentation. So we're going to start kind of looking at what we have, and we're going to bring the University of Alaska on first, and they're going to tell us a bit about their work on broadband, give us a little education on some of the technical terms, and they'll be pointing out the gaps, and that will be followed by the Denali Commission and Alaska Telecom Association, and then we'll be bringing in OneWeb with Pacific Dataport, who has some solutions for Alaska, as well as Next and Final SpaceX and Starlink. So we're going to start out with the University of Alaska. We have Mike Graves, Executive Director of Infrastructure and Cloud Services, along with John Boucher, Chief Information Technology Officer. So gentlemen, if I'm not sure which one of you, it looks like John maybe is going first. He's up on our Microsoft Teams on our television screen. So welcome, John, and please begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, Senator Hughes and members of the committee. Can you hear me? Okay, I heard a little feedback at first, but.
Yes, and could you move that chair so it's not blocking the screen? Yes, go ahead, John, we can hear you. Can you hear us?
Okay, thank you. For the record, my name is John Boucher, and I'm the Interim Chief Technology Officer for the University of Alaska. Joining me today is Mike Brossi. Mr. Brossi is the Executive Director for Infrastructure and Cloud Services for the University of Alaska's Office of Information Technology. And just will the slide deck move forward, Madam Chair?
Yes, we're taking care of that.
Okay. Here. Fantastic. Thank you. So next slide, please.
We have the one entitled Agenda.
Fantastic. So thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today regarding the University of Alaska's perspective about broadband in Alaska. It's an extremely important issue for the university as well as many Alaskans. Today we'll start by providing a brief overview of OIT's role at the University of Alaska in regards to broadband. We'll then describe the University of Alaska's wide area network footprint and some of our service challenges. And we'll try to give you a general sense of how a student's experience can be influenced by the broadband capacity that we're able to deliver to different locations that we serve. And finally, we'll take a look at some of the opportunities that may be on the horizon for improving the service that OIT currently delivers to University of Alaska network system users. Next slide, please. The university's Office of Information Technology is essentially responsible for provisioning broadband connectivity to many, but not quite every place where the University of Alaska has a presence. Through contractual arrangements with available vendors, we purchase connectivity for the three universities in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. And in addition, we provision 13 community campuses and colleges in various locations throughout the state. We also help support connectivity in some of our remote research places or our mobile workstations, such as our floating SV Seculia. It's important really here to distinguish that the UA system comes primarily to the committee from the perspective of a consumer of broadband services in a wide variety of settings, from urban campuses to regional hubs to rural and even remote research settings. To the university, broadband provides the university system an important tool in our toolbox that enables the university to deliver high-quality education and research to Alaskans and the world in what we strive to be have the lowest possible cost-effective rate to deliver those services. Next slide, please. To just give you a little bit of background, in 2015, the FCC defined broadband as at a minimum speed of 25 megabits per second download and a minimum speed of 3 megabits per second upload. Some refer to this as a 25.3. This essentially is a measurement of potential capacity to carry data to and send data from the end users. Note that this is on a per household basis, not, for instance, on a facility basis where you may have more individuals than the average household using internet services at any one point in time. This 25 megabyte download speed matches the target goal of the Alaska School Broadband Assistant Grant Program, which, with the legislature's help, was created to assist K-12 schools in increasing their internet download speed. Similar to the challenges that our K-12 systems face, resource constraints make it difficult to purchase significant connectivity speeds in rural locations. At some rural campuses, resource constraints mean that we can only afford a fraction of what the capacity that an urban campus receives. And comparing the bandwidth capacity of rural to urban campuses, it's common to have 3 to 10 times faster connections at even our mid-sized urban campuses than at our rural campuses. But most importantly, the issue for the university is how does that smaller bandwidth capacity transfer into the experience at the other end for the student? Next slide, please.
I'm just looking at the time, and there's a domino effect. So could you pick up the pace? You're welcome to speak a little bit faster, and I just want to get through all your slides. So please pick up.
Will do, Senator. So the UA's current bandwidth provisioning can translate into limitations for delivery and of instructional content that relies on a robust internet capability. In some instances, it's challenging to even have a single Zoom call function properly. And recently, the university got a $750,000 grant from the USDA to upgrade our equipment capabilities at rural campuses. However, in low bandwidth areas, that's going to be a challenge for us to overcome to fully leverage the capabilities of the equipment that we're requiring. In summary, for us, low bandwidth capacity has the effect of limiting the university's educational toolbox, particularly at our rural campus location. Next slide, please. So due to the high cost structures in rural areas, meaningful capacity to match the experience in urban areas is cost prohibitive. Those high costs creates a differential in the student experience And this differentiation in the experience is something that has been a long-standing issue that the university has been working on. I'd also note that unlike K-12 schools, institutions of higher education such as the university are not eligible for federal E-rate funding, which subsidizes bandwidth at a rate of 50% to 90%. The university is obviously interested in partnering with any parties who are interested in closing this gap between the urban and rural experience. And as a first step, we'd be interested in exploring any possibility of a 25 megabits per second minimum for UA's rural campuses, similar to what K-12 has standardized. Next slide, please. In the short-term horizon, we're hoping for some relief ahead for our high-cost rural locations, and we're working towards that goal. Federal funding opportunities for low-bandwidth areas are on the verge of growing. Recently, for instance, the university engaged with NTIA administrators to share the University's Alaska challenges, and we're attempting to highlight our challenges to rulemakers with respect to the forthcoming Connecting Minority Communities pilot program. We reached out with the intention that when the eligibility criteria is determined, our needs are considered, and we have a fair opportunity for this funding stream and attempt to address our needs at our rural community campus. There appears to be lots of additional momentum at the federal level for investment in broadband, and we'll be monitoring those developments for any additional opportunities that they unfold. We've been following and inquiring about new services, including satellite delivery, which are currently positioning itself to offer alternatives in our low bandwidth areas and potentially bring additional options to the marketplace. Some of these technologies, such as satellites, offer game-changing opportunities. And like many Alaskans, we're excited about the possibilities and willing to participate in pilot programs as these developments unfold. So if you'd like us to field any questions, we'd be happy to do so. Additionally, our contact emails are on the last page of the slide deck if you'd like to follow up through email. And thanks for this opportunity, Senator, to speak today on these important issues.
Thank you very much, John. I'm going to ask members right now. I know it's nice to be able to jump and ask questions, but if you could note your questions, and if all the presenters could stay online, we will take that last segment to ask questions. That way we'll be sure to get to all our presenters today who've taken the time and trouble and effort to prepare presentations. So with that, thank you, John, and University of Alaska will move next to the Denali Commission. And with the Denali Commission, we have Chad Stovall and Eric O'Brien. I'll allow them to introduce themselves. They're going to provide an overview of their previous work in this area and give the perspective of the rural interests with whom they work. And I'm sure we'll be identifying some gaps in the process. So it looks like Eric is online with us. Please introduce yourself for the record. And Eric, please present to us today.
Can you hear me, Madam Chair?
Yes.
This is Chad Stovall. I'm going to go first, if that's all right.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we appreciate the opportunity to address this body and discuss broadband in Alaska. It's certainly an important issue and something that we're fortunate to be involved in. We'd like to extend the warm greetings of our staff and also those of our interim federal co-chair, Mr. John Torrickson. He sends his regards. My name is Chad Stovall, and I'm currently the Director of Programs for the Denali Commission. I've worked for the Commission since June of 2019 and have spent 14 years in federal service working in various capacities in various locations. Currently, the Denali Commission manages a $1 billion portfolio. We have 15 full-time employees, and we operate on a current appropriation of $15 million per year. Short history about the Commission. We were established by Congress in 1998 under the leadership of Senator Ted Stevens. It's the second of the four regional commissions in existence. It is modeled after the Appalachian Regional Commission, which was established in 1965. We're overseen by a board of commissioners, each of whom have a vested interest in Alaska's growth and development. And the commission was designed to share parity with the state of Alaska regarding our development goals. First, we are unique by regional commission standards as we only have one service area, the state of Alaska. Second, this allows us to focus exclusively on Alaska's interests versus having to handle multiple states. Second, in addition to our federal co-chair, we have a state co-chair who represents the governor. This relationship between our co-chairs allows us to strategically work together with the state government on Alaska's critical development. In the 23 years that the Denali Commission has existed, we still adhere to our founding mission, which is to oversee the most efficient and effective delivery of resources to rural Alaska. Although our mission is still the same, the commission has been through various changes to size, staff, and funding. As we continually adapt to changes, we take the occasion to evaluate and ensure that our agency is appropriately calibrated. We do this based on changing needs, conditions, and data. Our recent efforts have been based on our 2018 strategic plan, which emphasized coordination and our ability to complement our partners across the state. Our strategic plan helped lay the groundwork to broaden opportunities and make significant program changes to our FY 2020 program budget. This was done through the introduction of new funding categories to our working plan for the agency. The categories that were included were economic development, workforce development, housing, medical facilities, sanitation, and relevant to this discussion, broadband. This commission has had a broadband as a high priority on its agenda since 2019. Through close coordination with multiple partners, we were able to host a series of meetings regarding rural electric internet connectivity in August of 2019. Attending those meetings from Washington, D.C. was USDA Rural Utility Service Administrator Chad Roop. Administrator Roop was able to engage with our Alaska stakeholders over several days and left with an appreciation to the unique challenges we face as a state when it comes to broadband. Coordinating and opening up these discussions with our local partners assisted in removing barriers to Alaska funding requests that competed in the 2020 USDA Rural Development Reconnect competition. From a high level, the federal government has been making efforts to deliver better broadband service and connectivity for the last several years when it comes to rural areas. COVID-19 has accelerated that to almost a warp speed. Unprecedented levels of federal broadband funds are making their way through the federal process, and many of our Alaska stakeholders are stepping up and assisting in directing as much of this funding to rural Alaska as possible. Since the start of COVID, a core group of federal partners have come together in an all-hands-on-deck effort. Likewise, with the state, they've been a tremendous resource in assisting the commission broadband wins across the state for the last year. I'd like to thank especially Commissioner Julie Anderson and her staff for the tremendous amount of time they've spent on this effort. The commission has been extremely lucky to have strong partners to help us work on strategic broadband development around the state. Lastly, the tip of the spear for the Denali Commission is our program managers. Shortly after our rural connectivity meetings back in 2019, the commission decided to further commit time and resources to the broadband enhancement efforts around the state by adding an additional staff member to manage our broadband portfolio. That program manager was Eric O'Brien. Eric joined us from working from Southwest Alaska Municipal Conference for several years. We feel fortunate to have him, and he's produced a number of results that he'll reflect on and talk about as part of a strategic coordinated effort that we've had ongoing for the last year. I'll turn over the balance of my time to Eric.
Thank you very much, Chad. Welcome, Eric.
Hi, Madam Chair, Senator Hughes, members of the committee. Thank you for inviting this testimony. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Well, as Chad said, my name is Eric O'Brien, and I'm the Broadband Program Manager for the Denali Commission. And today, I'm here to provide an overview of broadband or internet in Alaska. I find it's helpful to start out with a map to highlight the fact that we're all physically connected. I think you should have a map in the slide. Hopefully that's available to you. So the internet actually connects all of us. And I like to start here because most people or some people don't know that. And so this map displays Alaska's critical infrastructure, and it's referred to as Middle Mile, as our friends from the university pointed out. On that map, the green lines identify the fiber corridors, with the highest capacity. The blue lines identify the microwave corridors with less capacity, and the other communities have the least amount of capacity. This is in no way meant to be a comprehensive example. It's just a snapshot and a place for us to start the discussion. Now I'm going to cover the recent history and discuss some of the ways the Denali Commission has engaged with broadband. In the recent past, from 2010 to 2014, a group of service providers, nonprofits, elected and public officials formed the Alaska Broadband Task Force with support of a quasi-governmental body, Connect Alaska. And this effort was funded by the National Telecommunications and Information Administration. It's a mouthful, NTIA. with the stated goal to provide 100 megabytes of service to every household in Alaska by 2020. The 2014 Alaska Broadband Plan provided recommendations, infrastructure needs, cost estimates, and case studies. Now, while the ambitious goal of reaching 100 megabytes of second service was not reached, and that's a really ambitious goal, it did shine an important light on broadband, and this was a resounding success. In 2019, the Denali Commission funded an update to the Alaska Broadband Plan, this time with the narrow focus of ensuring that Alaska applicants were eligible for all possible points to the USDA Reconnect program. After successfully commissioning and completing the update and working with the governor's office and service providers in time for the December 2019 Reconnect 2 grant announcement for $600 million, we can look back on the success of that endeavor with 8 submitted applications, 6 successful projects, a 7th pending review, and total federal investment of $80+ million in Alaska. The Commission's updated broadband plan showed the value of the public-private partnerships to meet these critical infrastructure needs. Again, I draw your attention back to the infrastructure map and consider the challenges of serving Alaska's vast geography with its small population. And I have to point out that our service providers, our companies, have made substantial investments in Alaska, and I commend them for that. They've really done a fantastic job. And the value of this public-private partnership is well understood. The essential programs from the FCC, USDA Reconnect, Community Connect, Distance Learning and Telemedicine, those are all under USDA. The NTIA Tribal Broadband Grants, which I'll speak to in a moment, and other federal stimulus and infrastructure projects. And the point that I'm highlighting here is to identify the roles and the partnerships required to meet the challenges around broadband in Alaska. And of course, I suspect you know this better than most, but I wanted to lay the groundwork. So again, NTIA is currently, that's National Telecommunications and Information Administration, is currently preparing a $1.6 billion grant to fund tribal broadband projects in Alaska under 3 programs serving minority communities for workforce development and training, tribal broadband to connect tribal communities, and state broadband infrastructure. Each of these has their own pots of funding. With the tribal focus, these programs can prove especially valuable to Alaska with our 229 tribes. It's about 40% of the total nationwide, but we have a much smaller percentage as far as the total percentage of Native Americans. Still, the Alaska tribes represent a substantial underserved population given the challenges that we've outlined here. $1.6 billion is a large number, but not compared to the national need for tribal broadband funding. Alaska has some of the greatest need for broadband in the nation, and it's imperative that Alaska tribes begin planning now to maximize their eligible allocation. The Denali Commission may play an important role in helping these tribes. The specific strategy is not yet set as these NTIA grants have not yet been announced. However, we can look at the Commission's accomplishments over the past 18 months to consider how we could provide critical support. First, through our close coordination with the USDA, the Commission identified the potential problem of not having a broadband plan and the negative implications that had for the Reconnect funding. With prompt action, the revised plan was released within 3 months in partnership with service providers and the governor's office. And again, that resulted in over $80 million of federal investments across 8 applications for important infrastructure projects throughout Alaska. Second, and again, through close coordination with our federal partners, the FCC, the Denali Commission identified important opportunity for Alaska tribes to receive dedicated license to access valuable wireless spectrum capable of providing cellular, fixed wireless, emergency response, and even other services we don't know about yet. We started out strong with this program, workshops scheduled throughout the state, successfully hosting our first such workshop with the tribes of the Tlingit-Haida region from Southeast Alaska. All 17 tribes, private companies, and leadership from the FCC attended. Unfortunately, that was our only workshop with the onset of coronavirus. We continued reaching out as we could and stayed in close contact with the FCC. But with the July deadline looming, only 12 tribes had applied for their license. And with an 11th hour award, we funded a dedicated outreach program that helped 10 tribes receive their license in the last week of July. That's almost as much as all the tribes that had signed up through the first 6 months of the program. On the day before the FCC deadline, the FCC Bureau Chief, who had traveled to Alaska for our February workshop, extended the national deadline 1 month And Alaska took great advantage of this, signing up 180 tribes of our 229 and 95% of our eligible tribal lands. Essentially, that was almost everything outside of the urban centers. I'm just about done here. Third, and again, through close coordination with our federal partners at USDA, the commission worked with Alaska communities to provide technical assistance for a Community Connect program, resulting in double the previous record for Alaska applications to this particular grant. So now here we are with the NTIA tribal broadband grants, preparing $1.6 billion of grants. The commission is doing what we do best and closely coordinating with our federal partners to ensure tribes and all other partners have the best information possible with broad awareness and the need for the action soon. The Denali Commission will maintain our commitment to and mission to facilitate the services of the federal government for the benefit of all our Alaska partners to deliver infrastructure and economic opportunity for all of rural Alaska. Madam Chair, that concludes my testimony.
Thank you very much, Eric, and Chad, also incredibly informative. I know I've jotted down some questions, so if you'll hang on the line. Now we'll move on to Alaska Telecom Association. And this afternoon we have with us their Executive Director, Christine O'Connor. Christine, if you would please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation, please.
Thank you, Chair Hughes. It's a great pleasure to join you today. For the record, my name is Christine O'Connor, and I am the Executive Director at Alaska Telecom Association. I'd like to give you a brief overview of the state of broadband in Alaska. And to do that, we'll take a look at our statewide networks and especially focus on middle mile. That's definitely the term of the day right now. I'll talk about how various technologies fit in that landscape. And I also want to look at the opportunities to expand broadband even more and how we can accelerate that expansion. Next slide, please. But first, a really quick overview of ATA. This slide should look pretty familiar. Our members are the Alaska-based companies providing landline, wireless, and broadband services throughout Alaska. ATA was formed in 1949, and we have been supporting our member companies in connecting Alaskans ever since. Next slide, please. So a useful way of organizing my thinking around broadband infrastructure is to look at it in two parts, last mile and middle mile. Last mile is that connection from the internet service provider to your home or your business or clinic or hospital. Alaska's providers are deploying last mile at a rapid pace. In just the last several years, nearly 50,000 locations have been upgraded or newly deployed. A few projects recently completed include Alaska Communications has brought high-speed internet to 16,000 rural Alaska residents and will reach another 16,000 in the next couple years. Alaska Power and Telephone has completed high-speed broadband deployments in Tok and Southeast. Copper Valley Telecom completed a fiber to the home project in Tetitlik, supporting speeds of up to 25.3. And GCI has increased wireless speeds in Dillingham and surrounding communities, including constructing new towers in the last couple of years. Now, this is just a small sample of the deployment activity happening in the last mile space right now. Next slide, please. But last mile connection to your house, your business, isn't enough to get to the internet. You also need to connect to the world. You need middle mile. Alaska's middle mile is a combination of technologies. We have thousands of miles of fiber middle mile. Fiber is the gold standard. It allows huge capacity and very fast speeds. Where possible, fiber is the way to go. Next slide, please. But it hasn't always been possible to build fiber. Fortunately for us, Alaska has microwave networks extending hundreds of miles. And these microwave networks allow delivery of high-speed broadband and have been transformational in huge parts of Alaska. Next slide, please. And where there is no fiber or microwave connection, satellites provide that backhaul connection to the world and have done so for decades. Today, there are multiple geosynchronous or traditional satellite providers serving Alaska. And I think we'll hear from the LEOs after I'm done. We expect more capacity over Alaska in the coming year. Next slide, please. I want to stress Alaska is unique in our middle mile situation compared to the lower 48. Our counterparts outside rarely need to consider how they will get a middle mile connection or even how much it will cost. They have nearly ubiquitous access to fiber backbone connections. It's just a non-issue in most cases down south. But in Alaska, we still have large gaps where the only middle mile connection is satellite, which are much more limited in capacity. They often have latency issues and can suffer from interference. But things are changing rapidly for middle mile networks in Alaska. This was the middle mile network in 2010. You can see the undersea cables connecting us to the lower 48 and a little bit of microwave capacity. Next slide. Jump ahead to 2020 and you can see a dramatic change. In recent years, there has been massive investment in middle mile. There is new connectivity along the northern coast, huge expansion of microwave networks in southwest, northwest, and southeast Alaska. There's new fiber running up the Dalton Highway. And we have the first ever terrestrial and subsea links into Canada. Next slide, please. Some recent new middle mile projects include Alaska Power and Telephone constructed an undersea cable between Juneau, Haines, and Skagway, and they're doubling the capacity of their microwave network between Juneau and Ketchikan. Cordova Telecom expanded their microwave network in Prince William Sound. GCI completed a multi-year upgrade to equipment at 24 microwave sites in Western Alaska, adding more capacity. KPU completed Ketchikan 1, the first undersea connection to Canada, connecting to their fiber to the home network. MTA, Matanuska Telephone Association, constructed their Alcan 1 project, the first terrestrial connection from Alaska into Canada. Nishigaat Cooperative completed a major expansion of their microwave network. And I just want to note that both the MTA and KPU projects are both providing new routes from Alaska to the lower 48, which both expands the capacity of our networks and it provides geographic diversity in case of disaster or cable cut. There's just terrific new infrastructure. So I'll pause the laundry list there, but I want to give you a sense of the tremendous level of investment and deployment happening. Next slide, please. And I want to give a great shout out to USDA. They are making a big splash in broadband these days with their ReConnect program. Chad mentioned the engagement with Administrator Roop, which was incredibly helpful to ATA's members in helping them identify the opportunity which the ReConnect program is offering. And we've seen the results. ReConnect is bringing that missing puzzle piece to make major infrastructure projects viable, projects that we didn't know how they would ever come off the drawing board. You can see the list of communities here, which will all receive broadband service over the next couple construction seasons. And there are more communities kind of leading off from these, which will be able to be connected as a result of these major backbones, thanks to the ReConnect program. You know, including major undersea cables, which will connect on Alaska and that down southwest Alaska and the Aleutian chain, and from Juneau down to Prince of Wales Island. These are major projects that we have been waiting for years to figure out how to fund. And I also want to point out these grants require significant investments from the applicants and significant community support. So the awards being awarded these grants is really a testament to both the support from these communities and the company's commitment to investing in the application without knowing that they would get the award. Next slide, please. But despite tremendous progress in building broadband networks, we're not done. You know, the question is, how do we accomplish ubiquitous, sustainable broadband networks for all Alaska? It's not enough just to build them. You have to operate them and maintain them. How do we put those pieces together for the massive investment needed to serve our most remote communities, including those with the smallest populations? It's a complex puzzle, but we are seeing right now how some of these pieces are working together powerfully. First, investment from Alaska's telecom community. Every company in Alaska has been investing heavily in broadband networks for decades. In just the past 4 years, ATA member companies have invested over $1.2 billion in CapEx alone. And it's this investment in both last mile and middle mile infrastructure that allows nearly 85% of Alaskans to receive service at 25.3 megabits per second, or that FCC standard. and 80% are able to access 100 megabit service or faster. Second, it's critical we have stable, predictable programs at the federal level. Very often, federal programs bring that critical missing piece to make a project viable. And without it, broadband expansion just does not happen. But when federal programs adopt stable rules paired with requirements to deploy broadband, that is exactly what participants in those programs do. The state has a role too. Administrative Order 310 directed DOT and DNR to streamline their respective permitting processes for broadband facilities deployment projects. This is really important because right-of-way policies and fee structures can either accelerate or impede broadband deployment. And Congress has a big role. Seems like everyone is talking about broadband and infrastructure in DC right now. President Biden's infrastructure proposal is for $100 billion for broadband to build future-proof networks, which means fiber. It's an ambitious goal to bring affordable, reliable, high-speed broadband to every American. We can't wait for the details to be hammered out and for this opportunity to dramatically expand our broadband networks and connect all Alaskans. So with that, thank you very much for the invitation to be here today. I'll take a breath, and I'm happy to answer questions when we get to that portion.
Thank you very much, Christine. You did an excellent overview. We appreciate it. Now we're going to branch out and go to a couple of private sector companies that have some interest in Alaska. The first one will be OneWeb, but the person presenting is a familiar Alaskan to us all, former Senator Liesl McGuire. Welcome, Liesl. Please put yourself on the record. You know the routine, and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Liesl McGuire, and I'm representing OneWeb today. It's an honor to be before you and Vice Chairman Senator Myers and to see familiar faces in Senator Hoffman and Senator LV Jackson. It's really good to see you. We're here today because we understand that rural Alaska has been left behind. The digital revolution that has swept most nations on the earth has been slow to reach Alaska, particularly rural Alaska. Participation in the global economy is impossible without high-speed broadband. And yet, because of rural Alaska's low population and distance from telecommunication infrastructure, high-speed broadband has, for the most part, remained out of reach for private and public sector investment. Exciting new technologies are bridging the digital divide. OneWeb is hoping to be one part of that solution. So who are we? If you can flip the slide there. We are the first LEO spatial licensed constellation on the Earth. OneWeb was licensed by the FCC in 2017 and by the ITU in 2016. We are next generation satellite technology and have launched 146 satellites already, putting in place a global network that will complete coverage of Alaska and the Arctic within the next 2 months. The most important thing for you members of the committee who are focusing on this today, we are the only LEO spatial satellite company on the Earth that has committed to Alaska, first and all of Alaska. Through 4 years in working with the company and different iterations and changes in CEOs and direction, that commitment has remained at the top of OneWeb's focus. Our goal is to bring connectivity to communities, businesses, and governments. We're focusing on covering Alaska first, even before we move to the rest of the globe, and service will be available to Alaska beginning in late 2021. Next slide. As I mentioned, it's state-of-the-art satellite technology. I think that's important for members to understand that when we did the 2010 broadband report and the 2019 broadband report, satellite was a distant thought. It had been lower latency, clunky satellites, lots of promises, and not a whole lot delivered. We're in a new place in 2021. Satellites that OneWeb has developed through years and years of research are now the size of washing machines as opposed to the size of school buses. Placing them together in a constellation with seamless handshake movement over the state of Alaska provides user a 5G-like experience. Next slide. So as I mentioned, we've launched 146 satellites already. We'll launch again the 25th of April, the 25th of May, and so on. By the end of May, we'll cover the entire of the state. Our demo speeds have shown 40 milliseconds of latency up to 400 megabytes. We'll have demos coming to Alaska in 2021, and it's my hope that we can bring one down to Juneau, possibly when you resume session next year so that you get a chance to see it. How our connectivity works. Next slide. It's hard to see the slides, just so you guys know. Very simple. So as I mentioned, we've launched into polar orbit. These satellites are circumnavigating the Earth in a continual handshake pattern. They connect then with our gateways, and one of those gateways is already built in Talkeetna, Alaska, in partnership with Pacific Dataport. And also a shameless plug, we'd love you to come see it, to tour the facilities and also see a demo there. New jobs, new economic development. The gateway then beams up and back down from our satellite to user terminals. These terminals can be placed anywhere in rural Alaska, on a school, on a fire department, at a medical facility, on a home. To the right, you'll see a little image there. We're making partnerships with schools. Our first school partnership was with Government Hill. 2 years ago, we brought engineers to come in and talk about space, and actually we live viewed a launch with them. So we're hoping to make more partnerships with schools throughout your districts as well. Next slide. Is this the committed to sustainable growth slide? Next slide. Next slide.
It's committed to sustainable growth across Alaska.
Okay, there we go. As the least connected state, Alaska is not only physically but digitally divided from the contiguous United States. This means that internet technologies are not equally available in Alaska. Despite being the biggest state in the country, Alaska has the lowest amount of broadband infrastructure. You've heard about this from the other presenters. OneWeb can be a lifeline that can deliver in rural communities, overcoming geographical barriers, helping to connect communities, government, and businesses. OneWeb will deliver up to 200 times more capacity to rural Alaska and the Arctic. Alaskans will enjoy the benefits of freedom from other less reliable options, faster speeds enjoyed by many in the United States in the lower 48 currently, totally seamless web browsing and video conferencing, and connectivity at your home like you might have in Anchorage, a feeling like you're finally connected to the world. And I just wanted to make a note on that. As Christine was describing with ATA in their slide, at some point in further conversations, I'd like to give you a slide that shows you what OneWeb will actually be able to cover in the state, and also in combination and partnership with Pacific Dataport, because it is the entire state. Okay, next slide. COVID was an unprecedented demand on existing ecosystems. I don't have to tell you guys that. I'm sure you heard it from all of your constituents. Schools had unprecedented pressure with students out and having to work from the internet at the same time a parent might be home working. The pressure of that only highlighted this need for the hearing today, Madam Chairwoman. Next slide. Talkeetna, Alaska, as I mentioned, this is our gateway. I hope that's the right slide. I can't, it's so hard to see.
You're correct.
The slide there.
We're on Talkeetna, you're good.
Okay, great. So this was OneWeb's first gateway. As I mentioned, we committed to Alaska first and have delivered at every step of the way for 4 years. Our first North American gateway is located right here in Alaska in Talkeetna, and we're looking forward to having you come out and visit. Next, you can see our mobility market. So just one clarification that distinguishes OneWeb. We are a wholesaler, so we work in conjunction with existing local telcos on the ground to then sell to the consumer. We sell in the enterprise, maritime, aviation, education, cellular backhaul, and government. So coming to the close here, what is the OneWeb experience like? In all of our demonstrations, it's 5G-like experience. Again, it's a freedom from less reliable options for Alaskans. In some cases, Alaskans are completely unconnected. We have to remember that. But in more cases, they're underconnected. Faster speeds, seamless web browsing, and video conferencing. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Senate Community and Regional Affairs Committee. It's an honor to have been before you today. I also want to thank Dawson Mann for all the work that he did behind the scenes, having been a staffer and worked in the building. I know how hard he works. So thank you very much. We look forward to the continued conversation. And again, Madam Chair, I really hope that as you consider looking at broadband, you remember satellite as that unique gap filler that's come into the picture.
Yes, thank you very much, Lisa. It's exciting to hear what's happening, and I've got some questions for you if you can hang on, and I'm also going to be asking members if they might like a field trip to the Talkeetna site sometime in the interim, so we'll work on that perhaps if there's interest. So thank you very much. Next, we're going to move to Pacific Data Port, who is partnering with OneWeb, and Sean Williams. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for inviting us. For the record, I am Sean Williams, the Vice President of Government Affairs and Strategy for Pacific Data Port. We're very happy to be here today with many of our esteemed colleagues for such a great cause. I'd like to mention that even though I have about 16 slides, I'll only talk about each one briefly, except for a couple, and I'll go in a little bit more detail there. It'll be very data heavy, so you'll probably want to revisit it. We also have about 10 documents that we sent over to be submitted in a compressed folder. I'd like to encourage everyone to take a look at those as well. Today I'll cover rural broadband in Alaska as it is today, and then I'll cover our PDI projects, and then I'll cover challenges and solutions. Next slide, please. So in this first slide, I want to point out that there are three areas of funding. Middle mile infrastructure, last mile infrastructure, and last mile user subsidies. And when it comes to our Alaska telecoms and the federal government, they get about $380 million a year total in telecom and broadband subsidies. And I have that broken down here. On top of that, this is money that can be used for middle mile and last mile infrastructure, but there are reconnect grants, and that varies from year to year. But that is on top of the other money. As the ATA mentioned in their presentation, the problem is absolutely missing middle mile. But the second part of that problem is that there is no funding coming to Alaska dedicated only to middle mile. And I believe, I'll go ahead and go to the next slide, please. So slide three. Covering cost. The cost to build is very expensive in Alaska, and I broke that out per mile for each kind of middle mile connection. It does cost about five times more what it costs in the lower 48 to deploy terrestrial fiber and microwave in other states. Only PDI will be able to deploy middle mile infrastructure that's economical and which results in affordable broadband statewide. Telecoms and tribal entities can also use PDI's middle mile sources, both our Aurora project and the OneWeb project, to deliver affordable broadband anywhere in Alaska. In this chart, I want to point out that the different networks and their total cost divided by the total households they serve, you can see that very expensive projects are being helped. You know, the federal funding is helping pay for really expensive projects. Even the Yakutat network serving 270 homes breaks out to about $92,000 per household. These are factual numbers. All you got to do is pull up the total cost of the project divided by the households. So what happens when you have expensive middle mile build out? It turns into expensive backhaul, and it turns into expensive consumer pricing. And without going into a bunch of detail, you can see that the prices are very expensive, and our Aurora project brings the cost per megabit per second, which is how middle mile is purchased, down to less than $500 per megabit per second. And that's considerably less than the other choices that are out there as far as middle mile. And if it's fiber or microwave, you're limited to the areas that those options serve. Slide 5, please. Just to cover some facts, the FCC in the 2021 FCC broadband report stated that 36.3% of rural Alaskans have no wired broadband access. And I don't know about everyone else in the room, but I think that's completely unacceptable. I'd also like to point out that there is no organization or authority that is following the 2014 and 2019 Alaska broadband plans that were created. And no one's monitoring those benchmarks either. And the last thing I'll say about this slide is that there is no silver bullet in the room. You know, no one has it. Not Starlink, not OneWeb, not ATA, not PDI. It's going to have to be a concerted effort of, you know, different organizations working together to get broadband out to the villages, which is our main focus. When we look at new fiber, or excuse me, when we look at middle mile development and we look at fiber that's been built and kind of what's been, put in over the last 10 to 12 years, we agree that we haven't gotten very far. And even though the GCI Terra network has grown, there is a question about how much capacity has actually been added, because, you know, you can't just continue adding on to a network and not expanding the capacity and adding more and more people. It's like a pie, you know, 6 pieces gets cut into 22 pieces, into 50 pieces, and so on. The two of the 4 submarine cables that are going down the coast, I want to point out that those fibers are about 22 years old, The expected life is somewhere between 20 and 30 years. So out of those 4 cables going down the coast, the useful life of 2 of those 4 cables are questionable. The last thing I'll add on this is that the Q fiber that runs up around the coast there was done completely with private investor money. No federal funds were used, and there wasn't even a business case technically to build it out. I mean, we're thankful that it's up there, right? But it was done with private funds and not federal money. So what is Pacific Dataport doing to help? We have the Aurora project. It's 2 satellites that will be launched, the first one in December, and be operational shortly thereafter. And then about a year later, maybe close to 2 years later, depending on funding, we'll have a second, much larger satellite going up. And it's that second satellite that we are working on securing, we're fundraising for right now. But the system, the Aurora project or the Aurora network, will add about 100 gigabits per second of new middle mile infrastructure that's deployable anywhere. And our goal is to lower the retail price of broadband, which is 25x3 in rural Alaska, to $99 or less, considering all of the federal money that's coming into the state that could be used for user subsidies. It will get that price down considerably, but the numbers I'm sharing with you are without any federal subsidies. Liesl mentioned the OneWeb constellation, and that's pretty impressive. It's starting in Alaska, but it's worldwide, and it'll be starting in the next few months. We also built the Talkeetna Alaska Teleport for OneWeb and for any other LEO or GEO HTS middle mile providers that can be connected to the internet. And we started the Alaska Broadband Association. This is being used to notify rural Alaskans when broadband comes to their community. So we're pretty excited and proud of that. And then the final thing that I can share with you is that Pacific Dataport and Microcom are also working with tribes to deploy their last mile 2.5 gigahertz tribal spectrum WISP systems, which is wireless internet service provider systems. This is in case, as Eric O'Brien had mentioned earlier, tribes would like to deploy last mile broadband in their communities. The challenge with that is that they still need middle mile to get connected, right? So if you have fiber or microwave coming to your community, that's great. But if you don't, you're kind of locked out. So that's where satellite comes in. This is a good time to point out that OneWeb and the Aurora networks can be used in a hybrid capacity. It's a really good way to deliver a lot of capacity that requires low latency where necessary, and then high capacity where necessary as well. They kind of work together, and they both go into a modem to work together on that. So this slide does a good job of breaking down how the two networks, what they consist of and what they look like. The OneWeb network has 648 satellites, and ours are GEO HTS and VHTS. These are two satellites are part of the Aurora network. Our coverage covers all of Alaska. Each Aurora satellite covers all of Alaska. And our second satellite will be comparable to the 153 of the old C-band satellites, the old satellites that are kind of becoming old technology, and this is the new technology. So you can tell that right away, the two satellites that we're putting up there are considerably larger when it comes to capacity. This is where OneWeb connects to the internet. Let's get into the broadband challenges. I want to share that there is no state broadband organization to help develop state or federal policy. 90% of federal funding for telecommunications broadband comes in the form of subsidies, and building out fiber and microwave is very expensive. The state of Alaska and its residents have no say in where federal broadband funding goes, and the current FCC Alaska plan, legacy funding program, discourages competition, eliminates market entry, and disincentivizes expansion into new areas. Last on the slide, there is not one single idea or concept that will solve this problem, and it should be multifaceted and organized at the state level. I'm on slide 12, by the way. Sorry about that. Slide 12, broadband solutions, and I have two slides on solutions. Support the only hybrid satellite project currently being developed to bring affordable middle mile infrastructure that will deliver affordable broadband. And to us, affordable is $99 or less. Use the GEO HTS satellite middle mile to fill the gaps as the 2014 and 2019 Alaska broadband plans suggest. And the last thing on this slide is require federal broadband funding to be given to the state to provide grants or loans to middle mile programs, meet all four of these economic criteria. And I list them out there. We do realize that the state of Alaska is dealing with a fiscal crisis, but it can only take on policy, but it can take on policy and how the funding is used once it comes to Alaska. At this moment, the state has not taken a position to represent Alaskans. You can take on the FCC, USDA, and NTIA on how broadband is delivered in Alaska. We need to be more in control to make sure the Alaska broadband plans are executed, benchmarks are set, and goals are met. Slide 13. One solution is to establish an official authoritative Alaska broadband office, and there's some details there. You could utilize satellite middle mile to implement hybrid systems and lower telecom middle mile costs, therefore making middle mile much more affordable. The Aurora GEO HTS and OneWeb LEO is the perfect example of this new method. And then I do have four or five suggestions regarding the Alaska plan. Immediately allowing new members to join and have access to that funding would definitely be a priority. Providing funding for middle mile infrastructure would be a second priority. And then establishing middle mile pricing benchmarks. It's very interesting that the Alaska plan requires this and it has not happened yet. To date, I think we're on year 5 of 10 regarding that funding. And here we are, $750 million, almost $1 billion down the road. And it's interesting what has been developed. I'm rounding the edge here. Slide 14. I want to cover Starlink's coverage. Basically, this is a shot taken a few days ago on a website that tracks satellite deployment and where they are at that very minute. And I just want to point out that Starlink to date has 10 experimental satellites in polar orbit, and they have a small gateway. This is a gateway that is up in Prudhoe Bay on a trailer on a pad, kind of in a corner. So to date, that's the extent of their investment in Alaska. They're still navigating issues such as orbital debris and the 12 gigahertz spectrum sharing issues with competitors. So that's something to think about. And my next to last slide, basically slide 15, these are quotes from leaders in the community. I have these letters and I can send those to you. I think I'll also send you my recommendations regarding Senate Joint Resolution 13. I think that just off the top that it's creating another way at the state level for the industry to have more control of the market. And they already have that at the federal level. I think it's completely unnecessary. And we need to bring the residents and other stakeholders to the table regarding what we do with broadband money. And so my last slide, I'll finish by adding that I'd be happy to meet with anyone on the broadband topic. Thank you for your time, Madam Chair and committee members. We do appreciate your time and attention to this matter. It's very valuable. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I'm glad you weren't at the beginning, because your presentation had some pretty heavy duty stuff. And I've got a few questions. I hope we have time at the end. Now we're going to move to our final presenter, which is SpaceX Starlink. We have Patricia Cooper, Vice President of Satellite Government Affairs, and I believe Rebecca Hunter online as well. Looks like, Patricia, you are up on our screen. So introduce yourself and begin your presentation, please.
Thank you very much. For the record, I'm Patricia Cooper, Vice President of Satellite Government Affairs with the Space Exploration Technology Corporation, known as SpaceX. Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, and members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to participate in today's hearing and join all the presenters that were dedicated here to supporting Alaskans. It's a pleasure to represent SpaceX before the committee and discuss our Starlink satellite broadband project. As this committee reviews new broadband opportunities available to Alaskan homes and businesses, we're pleased to share information on how Starlink can contribute to the challenge of connecting Alaskans. Next slide, please. SpaceX was founded in 2002 to revolutionize space technology and has now become well known for designing, manufacturing, and launching advanced rockets and spacecraft. About 6 years ago, we started working on what is now known as Starlink, a global constellation of satellites that is committed to enabling universal broadband access around the world, especially where the traditional internet has been too expensive, unreliable, or just not available. SpaceX launched our first test satellites in February 2018, and since then, we've launched more than 1,400 Starlink satellites. In parallel, we're building out a network of gateway ground stations that link Starlink users to the fiber internet backbone. The image on the slide you see is a stack of 60 Starlink satellites just after being launched into space on one of our reusable Falcon 9 launch vehicles, and just prior to the satellites' separation and deployment into low Earth orbit. We're making pretty good progress towards our network build-out goals, and in October 2020, we're able to offer our first Starlink beta services to consumers in the northern continental U.S. We then added southern Canada in November 2020, and today we're serving over 10,000 beta users in six countries around the world. This summer, we expect to have sufficient satellites on orbit to serve customers located between roughly 53 degrees north and 53 degrees south latitudes. We then will turn to a campaign to deploy Starlink satellites to polar orbit in a way that will provide full coverage over all of Alaska and the Arctic. Next slide, please. Our top priority for Starlink is to deliver a high-quality broadband service directly to the consumer. Serving consumers directly from a satellite is a considerable challenge, but we believe Starlink technology will open economic education, and healthcare opportunities for people all around the world. And of course, it will also support solutions for government and enterprise customers. Starlink uses thousands of satellites to deliver broadband speeds that range between about 50 and 150 megabits per second, with ongoing improvements that will allow our customers to reach 300 megabits per second over the next year and gigabit speeds in the future. Starlink beta customers currently on the network are consistently seeing speeds over 100 megabits per second down and 45 megabits per second up. Also, because our satellites are over 60 times closer to the Earth than traditional satellites, Starlink delivers low latency broadband. This is the time that it takes to send data from one point to the next, and lower latency is vital to support the online services that are in demand today. Video calls like the one we're on now, or streaming video across multiple devices in the home, like everyone does, or even online gaming. Because Starlink satellites fly close to the Earth, our Starlink beta users are regularly seeing latencies between 20 and 40 milliseconds, which can support those kinds of services. It's part of SpaceX's essential culture to continuously iterate, and Starlink is no exception. We recently made several major upgrades that delivered even more reliability and significantly improved throughput to our beta customers. Now, for most beta customers, if communications with their assigned satellite is interrupted for any reason, their Starlink dish will seamlessly switch to an alternate satellite, resulting in far fewer network disruptions. And this ability to switch between satellites for the best signal is enabled both by our cutting-edge software and antenna tech in space and on the ground, but also by the diversity of our constellation of many satellites. Our Starlink software team also rolled out something called the dynamic frame allocation. It's a feature that basically dynamically allocates additional bandwidth to our users based on their real-time usage. So that allows better balancing of a load across the network and ultimately delivers higher speeds to individual users. Next slide, please. Starlink is designed to be easy to use and fast to deploy. All that is needed to connect to the service is the Starlink kit, which you see here, and a power source. Customers just sign up online at starlink.com. They'll pay a one-time $499 fee for the kit that you see here, a dish, a Wi-Fi router, all they need to get started. After that, the broadband service subscription is $99 a month. We like to say that the Starlink user antenna has more advanced technology than most fighter jets. It is lightweight, durable, and simple to operate. Once it's powered up, the antenna just automatically points itself in the right direction rather than requiring a trained professional to set it up. The phased array antennas then start to connect immediately to the Starlink satellites above. SpaceX has been offsetting the cost of the kit to make it more affordable to consumers during the early stages of our tech development. We've made a considerable focus on design and production of the Starlink kit, and we're on a good trajectory to continue to drive down manufacturing cost. Just a few months ago, the original kit cost about $3,000 per unit to produce. Today, it costs just about $1,500, about half that. And we're rolling out yet a further iteration of the kit that we think will shave off an additional $200 per unit. This is all part of our drive towards affordability. Next slide, please. Alaska and the North have been a part of our Starlink plan since its inception. This summer, Starlink will implement this plan with a polar orbiting launch campaign. This deployment drive will bring polar coverage, full polar coverage, north and south, and by early 2022, allow our first services for Alaskan homes and businesses. In addition to consumer and enterprise services, SpaceX is actively working with the U.S. Department of Defense towards providing military communication services in the Arctic and across northern latitudes. We actually launched our first 10 polar orbiting Starlink satellites in January of this year, as I think was mentioned in one of the presentations, with the Transporter 1 mission. These satellites were equipped with SpaceX-designed optical inter-satellite links, or space lasers, that we are testing to transfer data between our Starlink satellites in space. We're relying on a tracking telemetry and control ground station installed in northern Alaska to support these ongoing testing operations, and are developing three additional sites in Alaska to support future polar orbiting satellite operations and services. These space lasers that we're testing are a key enabling technology for full connectivity in Alaska and the poles. They reduce or eliminate our dependency on ground-based gateways to connect Starlink traffic to the internet. This is especially important in polar areas where fiber options are limited and gateways are difficult or impossible to install. This means that we would be able to connect even the most remote regions on Earth far away from ground infrastructure. Beginning with satellites launched to the polar orbit, Starlink will actually start incorporating space lasers on all of our satellites moving forward. Next slide, please. This past winter, Starlink's beta rollout in the northern U.S. states and southern Canadian provinces gave us terrific opportunities to test operations in extreme winter weather conditions. From our direct testing and customer feedback, Starlink demonstrated that it is reliable and hardy, even in deep snow, in snowstorms, and even at very low temperatures. We were also pleased to form strong community partnerships this winter that showcased how Starlink can be rapidly deployed to unserved homes and also provide essential remote learning, government services, and high-quality connectivity. One partnership I wanted to mention here that's depicted in the slide is with the Pikangikum First Nation Reservation, an Indigenous community located in a beautiful but very remote part of Ontario, about 300 kilometers northeast of Winnipeg. The Pikangikum are over 400 households, about 2,000 to 3,000 people altogether. We delivered Starlinks to the community in the dead of November for use in residences, community buildings, and businesses, bringing their available speeds from single-digit connectivity to reliably over 100 megabits per second. SpaceX is building similar partnerships across the U.S. and Canada and sees great opportunity for collaboration with Alaskan communities. Next slide, please. In short, Starlink is deploying rapidly, and we're growing our constellation and coverage area with each additional launch. We're actually building about 120 satellites a month, and we are aiming to launch twice monthly on our reusable Falcon 9 rockets, deploying about 60 satellites each mission. To date, our launch total is 1,445 satellites. In March alone, we conducted four launches and deployed 240 satellites to orbit. With this cadence, we expect to have continuous coverage for large parts of the world with just a few more launches. And then we will turn our attentions and our considerable efforts to polar campaigns this summer. We look forward to supporting Alaskans by early 2022. Final slide. Thank you again for the opportunity to participate in this hearing. We at SpaceX are really excited to provide this update on Starlink. We're proud about where we are so far, and we're going to continue to engage with the Senate, the state government, and communities across Alaska. We look forward to extending Starlink soon and adding to the connectivity options for remote and rural Alaskans. Thank you, and I look forward to any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Cooper. We appreciate the information you provided. It's all incredibly exciting and interesting. I also want to thank all the presenters for staying on time so we have do have time for questions, so I'm going to turn to members to see if they might have any questions for any of the presenters all the way from back at the beginning. Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I want to thank all the presenters and a special shout out to Senator McGuire. But anyway, with Starlink, I want to know how much faster is Starlink compared to what we have right now with GCI, which is the fastest. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Cooper?
Thank you. So when we're doing our beta testing, we tell our customers to expect between 50 and 150 megabits per second right now. But as I mentioned, we've just done some pretty significant upgrades both to software and to our operations that are showing speeds in excess of 200, in some cases even over 300 megabits per second. So if you want to validate that, I encourage you to look at Reddit. Everything we do and every customer we seem to have is reporting on their service, and we're really proud of those speeds. We expect those to continue to increase. We have lots of upgrades in mind. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, I have a few questions. The first one is for John at the University, if John is still online. You mentioned the Connecting Minorities Communities pilot program. I was wondering how much money is available through that program? Is that an annual amount? Have we exhausted it? Can you just give us a little dollar figure that associated with that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. They're still in the rulemaking stages of that, but we're anticipating that potentially we would be eligible for, I believe it's in the neighborhood of about $265 million, not all of it to us, but to those minority-serving institutions that we are among.
Okay, thank you, John. And this next one's for Eric O'Brien with the Denali Commission. You mentioned the NTIA, and you can remind us what that acronym stands for, $1.6 billion. Has that already been appropriated, or is that something that's coming through the federal infrastructure bill that's before Congress right now?
Yeah, NTIA, National Telecom and Information Administration. So Congress set the budgets. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Everybody, Congress set the budgets on December 27th, and those programs, those three programs, were supposed to be released 60 days after December 27th, but it was a lot of work. It was a Herculean task, and NTIA negotiated a new timeline. So right now it sounds like it's going to come out around this summer. And there's three programs: $1 billion for tribal broadband, $285 million for the minority communities, minority serving communities, and $300 million for infrastructure. And those require state and private sector partners to be eligible for the $300 million. And that's nationwide.
Okay, thank you very much, Eric. Now we'll go to OneWeb with former Senator Lisa McGuire. Where are the launches taking place? And indeed, it sounds like I was going to ask you if you'd be open to a field trip, but you already offered that. But I'd like to know where the launches take place. Is that anything happening in Alaska where we'd be able to view that, or is that taking place elsewhere?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, our initial launch contracts were fully funded and paid in Kazakhstan a long time ago. But what we have done is coordinate live launch viewings, like I mentioned, in schools and local businesses. But we're looking forward to the next chapter of OneWeb launches and haven't ruled out our Kodiak launch facility and other places as well. Those were early prepaid as a part of our initial business plan. So if the committee comes out, it's a chance to see the gateway and then a chance to see a demo where you're seeing a user terminal communicate.
We hope maybe we can have a field trip also to Kodiak to watch a launch perhaps someday.
Yes.
On your PowerPoint, and we won't, maybe Dawson, you can pull it up. On page 6 of your PowerPoint, you had a small map that showed where the service was good. And it was rather startling because it was only a pretty small portion there in red, South Central and South.
Correct.
Is that current to 2021?
Yes, I think it is. And this is one of those things I would love to spend some more time with Dawson to sort out. You guys have been given a lot of data today from different organizations regarding, you know, what the available coverage is and what the challenge is. But that is the current estimate of what that gap is right now.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, just on that point, just last thing, our hope too, and this is another thing I want to talk about, is our hope is actually to raise the standards for Alaska to what they are in the lower 48 as well, so that we're not just looking at 25 megabytes and so forth.
Correct.
So we can talk more later.
Yes, excellent. So next is Sean, and Sean, you are, I'm getting mixed up, with Pacific Dataport, I believe, yes.
Yes, ma'am.
I was wondering if you could, and I didn't want to interrupt and start the question thing, but you were throwing a lot of information out. And just give really quickly, we should have done this at the beginning, but what is the difference between a LEO and a GEO? And then we had a couple kinds of GEOs, an HTS and a VHTS. Could you please tell us? I know LEO is low Earth orbit, and I believe, is it geosynchronous Earth orbit?
Yep, that's correct. And the difference is the distance from the Earth's surface. And, you know, the LEOs fall into a category close to Earth,
And then the next category out is the MEO. And then after that is the GEO. And the interesting thing about GEO is that once it's at its address, kind of along the equator, it travels in a belt at the same rate as the Earth turns. So once we have our two satellites launched, they will be basically 18 to 20 degrees off the horizon, and they'll basically sit out there. The second part of your question regarding VHTS and HTS, HTS stands for high throughput satellite, and VHTS is very high throughput satellite. Kind of the cool thing about the VHTS satellite is that it has the ability to communicate with moving targets such as a cruise ship or an airplane. It also has onboard processing, so it doesn't necessarily need to go, it can go a shorter route as it processes data.
Okay, thank you for that. Sean, you also mentioned that there wasn't an organization. In fact, I'm going to go back. Your slides are really helpful as far as some of the needs and challenges, and I love it, too, when solutions are offered instead of just pointing out problems. But you mentioned there wasn't an organization really to help with the cooperation that of all this happening. But you did mention something about forming Alaska Broadband Association to communicate mm-hmm. with communities. Is that Broadband Association a possible entity that could bring everyone together? Or are you suggesting perhaps the state have an entity that would bring everyone to the table?
Yeah, I'm the latter of what you said. I don't think that it would be the Alaska Broadband Association, to hold that role. But I think that if there was a neutral organization that could help, bring all of the stakeholders to the table, including the providers, and including providers that only provide broadband and the middle mile providers. I mean, these are all people who currently don't have a seat at the table. And the organization that represents the telecoms does a great job representing them. And there's no doubt about that. Their time and efforts are definitely valuable. But in the same breath, I want to share with you that organizations like ours and the Alaska residents are not represented. And I think they should be, especially with all of this upcoming money that's coming to Alaska.
Yes. Thank you very much. And that's actually one of the reasons why the genesis for this hearing, not only because it's been something I've been interested in for probably about 5 years in regard. It all really started for me, just to give members a little background if you haven't heard, was being really concerned, having lived in rural Alaska, having lived in Hoonah and Bethel and Fort Yukon, and knowing the challenges for students to be able to access the kind of things that our kids can access in urban high schools and have opportunities for different, a wide menu of course offerings, and wanted to have a robust enough system across the state that a student interested in a two-way live video conference classroom, maybe in a small village, might want to take Japanese from a high school in Anchorage, for instance. So wanted that kind of thing. But then we also understand just through the pandemic the need for people to work at home and how important it now is to commerce and to healthcare, telemedicine. And so it is an important piece of infrastructure, and we think of roads, bridges, and ports as infrastructure, and we're now realizing the information highway should be part of what we consider infrastructure. And I remember asking, I don't remember it was when Senator Lisa Murkowski or Senator Dan Sullivan came and spoke before our body a few years back, asking the question, when will Congress consider the information highway just like as important as it does the physical roads and infrastructure. And so I'm glad that they are considering it. And that's one of the reasons why we wanted to get a snapshot of the needs and the challenges and some solutions, and hopefully work with the executive branch as well to bring about something. And also, I'll just say one final thing before I close out. Senator Lisa Murkowski was here a while back, and I was asking her about the prospects for funding in the bill we expect this summer or fall. And she said one of the concerns is that the language not be prohibitive to Alaska because of our unique challenges. What works, and you all stated it very well, what maybe works in the lower 48 may not be the solution for us. So that's one thing I'd like to ask all the presenters. If you have any suggestions of anything, our resolution is basically to send a message to Congress to make sure that we have flexibility with the funding that comes in to meet our unique needs. So if you could review SJR 13, we'd very much appreciate any input. Sean, you mentioned some important points. We'll take those into consideration. We welcome any language suggestions, any ideas or concerns about anything that's in it that you'd rather see worded differently. So, and at one point, one of you mentioned that there doesn't seem to be money dedicated to the middle mile, and that's a huge need. You know, perhaps we should be asking for a bucket of that funding dedicated to the middle mile. I'm not sure, but we'll be open to your ideas. And I'm going to repeat, just because we want to get this resolution through both bodies before we gavel out so we can get it to D.C. So it's going to be moving rapidly. So I encourage you to get with Dawson as soon as possible. And then I'm going to mention again to members, because we're going to have that hearing and pass that on Thursday, April 22nd, we will need any amendments from you by Wednesday, April 21st at 3 p.m. So with that, we are coming to a close. Again, thank you very much to all our presenters. Thank you to those assisting us today. And are there any final comments from committee members? Seeing none, that concludes our business. The next Senate Community and Regional Affairs Committee meeting will be on Tuesday, March 20th, right here at 3:30 p.m. And seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect. The time is 5 o'clock.